This is William and Lonsdale, a podcast about the legal ecosystem and the fascinating people who make it tick. Today, your host, Michael Green, speaks with the Honourable Michael Kirby, AC-CMG. As many listeners will know, Michael has had an enormous life in the law, and that was certainly reflected in our conversation. So we've decided to split this interview into two parts, with the second half being released in a fortnight's time. Michael's career includes the Council for Civil Liberties, extensive industrial relations work, becoming the inaugural chair of the Australian Law Reform Commission, president of the New South Wales Court of Appeal, the High Court of Australia, and extensive work internationally for the United Nations. As well as his strong and loving family, Michael attributes much of his success, both professionally and personally, to his partner Johan, who made sure he had balance when work threatened to dominate all else, and brought a perspective that ensured throughout the enormous highs of his career, his feet still remained firmly on the ground.
But when I first met my partner, Johan, I took him along to the SRC to see me at work reporting. And he came into the room, he watched it, and when we walked out, he said, "This is all a bit childish, isn't it?" Sometimes you need a partner or a friend who will tell you the truth and see the world, your world, in a different light.
Our guest this morning in Lives in the Law is the Honourable Michael Kirby, AC-CMG, formerly of the High Court of Australia. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Michael, let's go back to the start. Childhood in Sydney. Where did you grow up in Sydney? How would you describe your childhood?
I grew up in a suburb called Concord, which was then regarded as in the western suburbs. Now it's in the centre or the inner west, and it's the only suburb in Sydney that doesn't have a hotel. And it therefore was, in a sense, a rather Protestant part of Sydney. I grew up in a loving family. I had wonderful parents and wonderful siblings. The surviving siblings still get together, generally once a fortnight. I was surrounded by love. I was always sure I had love, and that was a very important ingredient to the starting of my life.
There's a strong legal bent in the family, you being a Justice of the High Court. I think a brother was a Justice of the Supreme Court of New South Wales.
Correct.
And another brother a solicitor.
Correct.
Where did the legal bent come from? Was it in the family?
I think because I was the first born child and was seen by my siblings to be a studious sort of a person, that led to an interest by my brothers, and both of them went on to be successful lawyers. My brother David was a judge of the Supreme Court of New South Wales, and his life was wall-to-wall murder. And he was, I think his job was much harder than any job I had in the law, keeping all those detailed facts in your brain and dealing with the case fairly and lawfully. And he was well reputed as such.
As a criminal trial judge?
Yes, basically criminal trials and appeals. He was a good lawyer, a bit conservative, but I'll forgive him for that because most lawyers are conservative. But I was not, and I'm still not, and I'm still pushing the envelope, which is important for some lawyers to do.
But, Michael, back to what influenced you. I think you came from a working-class family.
Yes, my mother didn't like that expression. She regarded herself as sort of one of Mr. Menzies' aspirational class. But I would say it was a working-class family, not well endowed with money. Neither of my parents went to private schools. They both went to public schools. My mother to Sydney Girls High School, which is a fine public school. And I went on to Fort Street High, but via the Summerhill Opportunity School, which is something you Victorians have got to learn about, because it was a public school, a public primary school, but it was a selective stream of so-called gifted and talented students. We were streamed into these schools to have a somewhat different primary school education in the last 2 years of primary school. So that's it left me with a very strong conviction in favour of public education. And it's one of the themes that comes out in a lot of the things I've done all my life.
Your career at the very well-known and famous Fort Street High School culminated in you being a prefect and handing out detentions to some of your fellow students.
Well, not many. I was, even then and still today, I was a bit of a softy, and I only put two students on detention. One of them, Percy Birrell, went on to become a Roman Catholic priest. The other was John Singleton, and John Singleton went on to become John Singleton, and he was a big guru in advertising and promoting television advertisements, often for political parties, and he's still a good friend, and I'm about to reverse roles and interview him at Fort Street High School for the purpose of a series which are going to cover some of the famous old boys and old girls of the Fort Street High Schools.
You go on to Sydney University, or the University of Sydney, in the early 60s. That was a time of great foment in universities around the world, in the Western world anyway. What was Sydney University like at the time?
Well, actually, I arrived at Sydney University in 1956.
Oh, really?
So I'm a very ancient person. You've got to adjust your thinking. You're just a child if you're a child of the 60s and 70s. I was a child of the 50s.
You were at school during the 50s. Quite early, you became aware that you were gay. How did you handle it? Because at my recollection, I grew up in the 50s, you know, probably a few years behind you. The community was basically homophobic.
Oh, very homophobic. And it was something you learn from the afternoon newspapers, The Sun and The Mirror. That was a bad career move. It was something where even very famous people were caught, often by very handsome young policemen in public facilities, and that led to a scandal, outrage, front page stories. Even the great Chilean pianist Claudio Arrau was due to do a concert in the Sydney Town Hall, and he was nabbed by policemen in one of the toilets of Sydney Town Hall railway station. And, you know, it was a terrible thing, and I knew, oh, whatever happened, I mustn't shame my family and my parents. So I just sort of put it in the back burner and didn't pay a lot of attention. But it's something which has left me with a sense of grievance that was inflicted upon me by my society. And it really remained much the same until the 1990s and even after.
You were heavily involved in student politics while at uni, a time of great upheaval in society with the Vietnam War in particular. There are also issues around Aboriginal students and Aboriginal rights. What role did you play? Why did you become involved and so heavily involved in student politics?
Well, you've mentioned that I discovered my sexuality and that was a bad career move, and therefore I had to pretend that I was straight, and I gave a very good pretense of that. Though not to the point of having a walker. I drew the line at being a hypocrite. I just didn't have a sexual life, and that's basically what happened. And whereas a lot of students, most students at the time, in the heady days of the conflicts over the Vietnam War and the White Australia policy and so on, they were at parties and having a great life and enjoying themselves, and who knows what they got up to. But I had to do something with my time to take my mind off this issue, and so I got involved in student politics. And I was I was the most successful student politician, certainly to that time. I was elected president of the Students' Law Society. I was elected president of the Sydney SRC at about the same time as Gareth Evans was elected president of the Melbourne University SRC. And I went on to be president of the union, a life member of the National Union of Students, and that was my way of escaping thinking too much about my sexuality and just finding something that was uplifting, where I was very, very successful. It was as if I was in speed dating and I was having enormous success in speed dating. Well, that was the only way I got my buzz, and so that's what I did.
But you mentioned the word uplifting there. I'm assuming, as well as a way of compensating for repressing your sexuality, there was also a desire to do something worthwhile.
Yes, but I wouldn't exaggerate that. My father was a strong supporter of the Labor Party and was deeply distressed by the split, especially in Victoria, of the ALP. And we used to sit there and listen to the election together, all the rest of the family. My mother was safely in bed, and so the other younger siblings were. But my father inculcated in me a strong sense of the need to redress injustice. So I did have a motivation to improve the world. But I have to be honest, I think my main motivation was to take my mind off my loneliness and my inability to go in for all the activities that those around me were going in for, and really pretend, no, I'm dedicated to making the world a better place. Well, I was, but it was a more complicated matter, as things tend to be in life.
William and Lonsdale is brought to you by Greens List, one of the leading multidisciplinary barristers' lists in Australia. Greens List believe in promoting conversation around the ideas and issues that shape not only our legal system, but our wider community.
Michael, let's get so you finish at Sydney Uni, do your articles, and remain a solicitor for the next 4 or 5 years.
I think it was a bit more than four. I think it was from 1962 until 1967. So it's 5 years, yes.
Mm-hmm. What was that period like? What sort of work did you do? Did you have a general sort of articles, or was it specific? And then what was your work as a solicitor?
Well, I actually received a maximum pass, as we called it, in the leaving certificate in New South Wales. It was 2 first-class honours and top of the state in history and 4 A passes. That was called a maximum pass. And I was therefore hopeful that I might find an easy path into the legal profession. But at those times, the Australian legal profession, and at least in New South Wales, was very much in hands of daddy. If you were a child of daddy, then you had no trouble advancing in the legal profession. And despite my brilliant results, I found it very difficult to secure articles of clerkship. Ultimately, I secured articles not in one of the big end-of-town firms, but in a very small firm which was practising for cases for the Labor Council of New South Wales. So most of my work as an article clerk was for workers who were injured, and it was mostly workers' comp. And some of the people who went to the big end of town used to look down on that experience, but I would often say, to their intense irritation, that a day in the workers' comp with, say, 5 cases was the closest I ever came to preparation for the special leave list in the High Court of Australia. You had to keep a lot of facts and a lot of law different in your mind. You had to progress from one case to the other. You had to work extremely hard. And it was all about orality. In those days, the bar was substantially about orality. We had lots of jury trials, juries in civil cases, the Workers' Compensation Commission had specialist judges, and I got on my feet. Even in the first days as a article clerk, they said, go up and the case is before Judge Rainbow, ask for an adjournment until later in the morning, the barrister will be there. And so within days of my arrival in this exciting world of law and courts, I was on my feet, and I'm still on my feet. And that was a very good training, and that's what I did. And when I left that firm and had got my law degree, I went to the other side of the coin. I crossed the Rubicon and went to the dark end of town, and I was appointed young solicitor in a big legal firm in Sydney, but the principal had been a barrister and he hated barristers. And he said, I want you to be somebody in our firm who we can always go to with any problem, wherever it is, and to be available to us. And thereby we'll avoid going to these barristers. And I said, yes, all right, I'll try that. And that's basically what I did. So really, although I was a solicitor, I was what we'd now call an in-house counsel, but I didn't have the support that in-house counsel did. So I had to be writing the letters, securing the subpoenas, organising the witnesses, doing all the work of a solicitor. But as well as that, I then had to get on my feet and argue the cases. And at night, I was the president of the SRC. So it certainly took my mind off sex. If anybody out there is thinking of a way to do that, I can recommend just being extremely overworked, which is what I was, but I never complained.
And so this lasted for 5 years, this regime of heavy work and being, in effect, an in-house counsel. Being in-house counsel and doing both the work of the solicitor in preparing the case and then doing the appearance, is there actually an advantage or a benefit in the fact that you are so familiar with the case? Or is, in fact, better to have a fresh set of eyes come in and do the advocacy?
Well, I think now, if you can afford it, our system of having a barrister doing the advocacy is distinct from the solicitor doing the preparation and the advising and counselling is a good system. I mean, once when I was president of the, or chairman of, called then, of the Australian Law Reform Commission, a legal conference was held in Tasmania, and they'd invited, usually for Australia, the president of the Verfassungsgericht, which is the German Constitutional Court. And he came out and he said, to the great shock of the Australian legal system, you in Australia, you've got the wonderful, your legal system is wonderful, it's magnificent, but who can afford it? You have the Rolls-Royce system of the world. In Germany, we've just got a little Volkswagen system, but who can afford a Rolls-Royce and who can afford a Volkswagen? And so that really was the truth of the matter. And so it's left me with a belief that our system is good, but we've got to do something better to improve access to law and access to justice for ordinary people from ordinary suburbs who really have a problem and they've just got to forget about it. If it involves going to court, it's just too expensive.
I agree entirely, Michael. My experience in the law is about 50 years, and from the time that I started as an article clerk doing magistrates' court cases for insurance companies, crash and bash, till now, the expense of litigation has just skyrocketed, you know, beyond almost words, and normal people really can't afford to litigate.
I don't know a single judge who would litigate anything. And I wrote recently to somebody who litigated a matter in New South Wales and lost. There, you've got to think very carefully about going to court because it's just so many imponderables and there are lines of appeal, and so it can just keep going and really ruin you. And that was the legal system in my day. And I have to say, the partner who appointed me to my post-graduation job was very supportive of what I was doing in civil society and very supportive of continuing involvement in the issues of student politics, even after I had become a solicitor.
Michael, can I clarify one point there, maybe for our Victorian listeners? In Victoria at that time, you did a law degree in 4 years if you did a straight law degree, and then the fifth year was your articles. Do I remember that in New South Wales, you went out and did articles for maybe a couple of years in the middle of your degree?
You did the articles after the first year of law, and they lasted 3 years. You therefore were working in the day in a legal firm, and then at night or early in the morning, you would go to lectures in the old law school. And that was how it worked and had worked from the 1890s.
And hence you were able to be involved in student politics at the same time as practising.
That's right. I did an economics degree after I finished my arts and law degrees, and that gave me a fig leaf of respectability at being at the university, and I did very well in the economics degree, and it was actually useful later when I became a deputy president of the Arbitration Commission, because that was all about economics. I was elected a fellow of the Senate of the University of Sydney, which is like the council, and I was elected to represent the undergraduates. I was elected by the undergraduates, and for the first time, I went along to the SRC meetings because I'd had glory days earlier as president of the SRC, and I reported to the Senate, to the SRC, about my glorious achievements in the Senate, and because the Senate meetings in those days were closed, nobody was there to contradict me. But when I first met my partner, Jan, I took him along to the SRC to see me at work reporting. And he came into the room, he watched it, and when we walked out, he said, "This is all a bit childish, isn't it?" Sometimes you need a partner or a friend who will tell you the truth and yeah. See the world, your world, in a different light.
Michael, as much as you say you kept yourself very busy with SRC work and student politics, etc., to cope with you repressing your sexuality, I think you're selling yourself a fair bit short. I think you've got a very strong social conscience, and it comes out in a lot of the things you have done, one of which was the Council for Civil Liberties. Can you just tell us what, I mean, we know the phrase and we know such a body exists, but really, what does it do and what did you do and how did you get involved? Why did you get involved?
Well, I got involved because my glorious career in student politics was beginning to peter out. And the result of that was I needed something else to fill up my days. And I went to a meeting of the Council for Civil Liberties. And looking back, it's interesting to go around that table and to see the people who were there, who later became leading politicians, leading lawyers, colleagues in the Court of Appeal and colleagues in other courts. So it was a good career move, but I wasn't doing it for that reason. I was doing it because they were tackling all sorts of issues, which were also being tackled by students at the time, but they were tackling them in courts to pursue issues of justice in our society in respect of disadvantaged people. And, of course, First Nations people were among the most disadvantaged in those days. One of the issues that came up quite early in my piece in the Council for Civil Liberties of New South Wales, which was organised on state lines, was a case concerning the discrimination against Indigenous people in country New South Wales. Jim Spiegelman, later the Chief Justice of New South Wales, led a group of students to Moree because Indigenous people weren't allowed in the Moree baths, inferentially, because they were regarded as not appropriate and the Moree hot baths were not a proper place for them. And he succeeded there. But I went not as a student activist, but as a lawyer. I was the honorary solicitor for the SRC after I stepped down from president, and that led to a stream of cases coming my way, including many later on the Vietnam War and conscientious objection, which is another story. But a case came up concerning the cinema in Walgett. And the cinema in Walgett was one of the few centres in the town where people could come together. This was pre-television and was a very important community place. but Indigenous people were allowed downstairs. They were allowed to go where it was vinyl seats and lino on the floor. They were never allowed to walk up the grand staircase, the carpeted staircase, into the dress circle, as it was called, and sit in the dress circle in comfy seats, which were of velvet. So that was the discrimination.
Sounds like apartheid, doesn't it?
Well, it was very like apartheid, actually, as I look back. We were apartheid light. We had white Australia, and it was enforced rigorously by Labor and coalition governments, and it had the strong support of the people of Australia. It had been one of the foundational principles of the Federation, and there were very few people who questioned it, but students in those days began to question it, and it led on to the referendum that changed the constitution in 1966, and the net result of that was that the Indigenous people gained a degree of legal representation. But deeper than that was the form of discrimination, such as the Walgett cinema. And there was a young Australian university student, Owen Westcott, who was actually the son of one of the workers' compensation judges, who was a very conservative man, but they tend to breed very radical children. And he had organised a group of students, went up to Walgett on a bus and tried to liberate the cinema. He went up the grand staircase. He bought the tickets at the locket downstairs. He just went as a young white man, bought the tickets, and then he gathered a group of Indigenous young people with him and walked up together to the glorious dress circle. And the manager rushed out and said, you're a troublemaker from Sydney. This is not, you know the rules here. This is Walgett you're in now. You can go downstairs. It's the same film. And you'll be able to see it. You can't come upstairs. That's just the rule. And he said, I've got my tickets, and I insist on my legal rights as a person with tickets. And he said, no, you knew the rules and you've tried to trick us. We know you city slickers. We're not going to let you in. And so he called the police, and the police arrested the students and charged them with trespass on being in a closed space under the control of others without the consent of the owner. And that was litigated before a magistrate. And I took to Walgett. I thought, I'll go for the top. So I went for two lawyers who did a lot of work for the CCL, the Council for Civil Liberties. And one of them, the leader, was Gordon Samuels QC. Now, he was Jewish, and a lot of Jewish lawyers have tended to be more liberal in issues of discrimination because they've suffered very greatly in their community. And so he came up with Mr. Hardwick, Malcolm Hardwick, and they both argued the case. They relied on a Privy Council case from Australia, Sydney Harbour Ferries, of about 1906. And the result of that was we came within a whisker of winning the case, but the magistrate ultimately downed us. But he gave the students, all of them, black and white, he gave us what was called 556A, which was the section of the Crimes Act of New South Wales for dealing lightly with first offenders. So that was how it was disposed of. But, you know, in the very week I resigned or retired as a Justice of the High Court of Australia, all those years later, I got a letter out of the blue from that magistrate who said, I followed your career with great admiration, and I was the magistrate in Walgett when you came back with Mr. Samuels to fight the case. And I wish I had been able to do something for you on that occasion. But what you probably don't know is that 2 weeks after my decision, the cinema in Walgett changed its rules, and it allowed Indigenous people to go upstairs and downstairs, and therefore you lost, but you won. That really shows how important courage is in the legal profession and how important lowly practitioners, young solicitors, can be, and how important it is to have senior lawyers supporting them. My master solicitor, or my master lawyer, the head of the legal firm I went to after I graduated, was Bruce Holcomb, the man who hated barristers. But he supported civil liberties, and he supported my getting involved, and so I did. And that was the story of Walgett Cinema, but it's also the story of Australia and of how we had so much prejudice, and I think perhaps still do, against First Nations people, and how we got to get over it.
Lives in the Law is proudly sponsored by City Maps Illustrated. Their recent publication, The Melbourne Map, is a celebration of our wonderful city. This stunning, hand-drawn illustration, which took more than 3 years to create, is available as an art print, jigsaw puzzle, and calendar. The perfect acquisition for your home, office, or corporate gifting.
Let's get to the part of your career, Michael, where you become a barrister. 1967, I think, you come to the bar. Sydney Bar, you immediately do industrial relations work, which I don't think you'd ever done before on my reading. How did that come about? I mean, and was it a big learning curve for you to pick up IR work?
Well, I didn't really want to do it. We have the cab rank rule in New South Wales, as in Victoria and other parts of Australia. So I had to do it if it was something that was within my field of skill. And the net result was that I was sitting in my chambers one day working on cases that I was very familiar with, and my practice as a barrister had really got me away from workers' comp. And a lawyer rushed in and said, we need you in the Industrial Commission of New South Wales. This was Michael Sweeney, who later became a judge of that commission. And I said, oh, no, I can't go over there. I don't know anything about it. I don't know the procedures. I don't know the substantive law. It would not be fair to your client. By the way, who is your client? The teacher. Federation of New South Wales. And I knew enough about industrial relations to know that they were always difficult. And they had sacked about five barristers before me, and they were scraping the bottom of the barrel to get somebody to go into industrial relations. And he said to me, Michael Sweeney, it's just like the SRC. You'll feel you're at home. It's a matter of arguing across the table and accepting, in this case, the judges or commissioner's decision, and you'll be a natural. So I said, oh, very well, Michael, I suppose so. And so I went ahead, and it was just like the SRC before. It was actually before a commissioner. So I got to like it. It was about power. It was, there was law in it, but it was largely a matter of taming and mollifying the brute power of employers and of unions in their conflicts, and finding a process and an institution that could deliver general justice, but not just by the strict letter of the law, by ameliorating the strict letter of the law. And that I found very attractive. And in fact, it really is the foundation of modern legal practice, which is mediation, conciliation, arbitration, expert determinations, all these ways outside the super expensive areas of the law to provide a much quicker, cheaper, discussing type of environment in which you can come to justice.
And reach a practical decision that both parties can work with, even if it mightn't be exactly what they want? Is that...
Exactly.
Do I get that feel?
No, that's exactly. It actually was established first in New Zealand. Feisty little New Zealand does a lot of things before we do in Australia. They've got a much simpler legal system and constitution. But they had, in the strikes of the 1890s, they'd established an industrial commission, and we copied it in New South Wales in the 1890s. And the successor of that institution was the body to which I was dragged, screaming and kicking, to look after the Teachers' Federation. And that was how I got into it. But once I got into it, I was swamped with it because, of course, it was then and still is in the Fair Work Commission. It's a very busy jurisdiction. And when I was at the end of my brief but glorious practice at the bar, down here in Melbourne, for Bernie Gaynor, who was a solicitor who comes from a significant legal family, and it was for the power unions, the unions involved in electricity supply. And my job was to get the lights back on in Victoria, and it was before a full bench of the Arbitration Commission. Sir John Moore, a very fine judge, was presiding. After the case was over, he said, he sent a message, "Mr. Kirby, the President would like to see you in chambers." And I went in and he said, "I'm authorised by the Minister for Industrial Relations, who was Clyde Cameron, to offer you a position as a Deputy President of the Commission." And I said, "Oh, no, no, I can't do that. I'm much too young and much too inexperienced." He said, "No, he doesn't want, as he put it to me, an old fuddy-duddy. He wants to have somebody who's young, energetic, and can take on the position." And he had just appointed Mary Gaudron. And both Mary and I, when we ended up together on the High Court, often talked about those days in the practical world of industrial relations and how that had lessons for all of us in the legal profession to make the law more approachable and to provide mechanisms whereby they could solve problems in a way that people could tolerate, even though they might not be happy, and in a way that was cost-effective.
So, Michael, Sir John Moore, I think you said, was the president at the time. He's offered you this position. How old were you?
35. I was 35, and the position went with the rank of a judge, the rank, title, and salary of a judge of federal courts. So, and in those days, certainly, the Arbitration Commission was a very important tribunal. It dealt with the issue of equality in women's wages and the issue of equality for Indigenous Australians. It was doing all sorts of things that Parliament was neglecting doing through its awards system. And in fact, Mary Gaudron had been appointed as a deputy president about 6 months before I was. And I was furious that I'd heard that she had been appointed. This was during the Whitlam government, because I was in London at the time, and I thought, if I had been there, maybe the call would have come to me. And it came to Mary, and she became, at 32, the youngest person ever appointed to judicial office in Australia, to federal judicial office, and I became the second youngest, and H.V. Evatt was the third youngest. Evatt was 36, but of course he was appointed to the High Court of Australia. I was down in the lower quarters, but still a very important tribunal and very exciting and interesting.
You weren't concerned that by taking a judicial appointment so young that you might get stale and you might get sick of that sort of role? I mean, most people take judicial appointments maybe in their 50s or older, and they're concerned that if they take it too young, they can get stale in the job.
Well, I had just taken a year off, and with my partner, Johan, we'd driven overland, as many Australians did in those days, through India, Afghanistan, Eastern Europe, to the Netherlands and to England. And so I had just sort of come through this rethink of my life, and Johan was very strongly supportive of taking the position. We had a council of war with my parents and my brothers and sister, and we decided that this was something that would be worthwhile, that it was something that was a call to public service. And my clerk, Greg Isaac, when I told him about it, he said, "Boss, this is a very important job. You can't turn this job down. This is a very important national job, and so you should take it. And I generally did what my clerk told me, and, and so I did it. I never regretted it. But Michael McHugh, who was a barrister at the time, said, this is the end of your practice. This is the end of civilization. You'll be in a siding, you've cut yourself off from a glorious career. And I said, oh, well, I'll take my chances. And so that's what happened.
And didn't, along with Mary Gaudron, didn't Michael McHugh join you later at the top of the pyramid?
He did, but that was in the High Court of Australia.
Yeah.
But he actually got to the High Court before I did. It was a race to the finish. but Michael McHugh was a very, very good barrister and a bit conservative, you know. But then again, I'd say that about virtually all the judges that I've known and worked with. Mary Gaudron wasn't so conservative, except in matters of equity. And she and Justice Gummer were often horribly conservative in that area. But it was a great opportunity. And I had no idea that just around the corner was an offer to me to become the inaugural chair of the Australian Law Reform Commission. Some people thought I took the Arbitration Commission to get the judicial handle, to give me respectability, to become the chairman, now president of the ALRC. But it wasn't that way. I was expecting that for the foreseeable future of my life would be in the arbitration area.
Michael, can I just clarify that, because this isn't clear to me. When you took the position as the first chair of the Australian Law Reform Commission, you had to leave the Conciliation and Arbitration Commission.
I didn't resign my commission. I continued my commission. The Act contemplated that members of the commission, deputy presidents or president would or chairman, would be judges of federal courts. And I had the rank, title, status and salary of a judge of a federal court, and I was treated as such, and I was titled as such. And so I was very resistant to taking the position in the Law Reform Commission. Who'd ever heard of it? It was something completely new and different. I had to be persuaded. I had to have my arm twisted. But there was no one better at twisting arms than E.G. Whitlam and L.K. Murphy. I didn't really know Gough or Lionel, though I'd done a lot of work in industrial relations with Neville Wran. Neville Wran was a leading lawyer in the industrial relations area, and I think it was he who spoke to Lionel, his close friend, and said, there's this young lawyer in New South Wales, you should look at him, look at his career and see whether you have something that you can use him, because he's not political and he will work very hard and he will succeed. And so Lionel offered me this, and I was very reluctant to take it. But in town at the time was Geoffrey Robertson, QC.
There's a few big names here, Michael.
Yes, and he was then not a QC, but he was a Sydney barrister and Rhodes Scholar. I'd written a reference for him to become a Rhodes Scholar for New South Wales, and he did. He went to London. He was in Sydney at the time, and he said, you have to take this job. He was mimicking the language of Greg Isaac, my clerk. He said Lord Scarman, or Sir Leslie Scarman, was the first chair of the English Law Commission, and he did a magnificent job, and he ended up on the House of Lords. So this is the first step to the High Court of Australia. You've got to take it. It's a wonderful opportunity and wonderful experience. It'll prepare you for really important judicial work, and so it did. So I went to see Lionel and brought Geoffrey along, and Lionel said, I want to offer you this position. You've got to take it. I said, oh, it's got to be somebody older. And no, I don't want any of them. They'll only be against reform. I want somebody who's for reform. And so I said, oh, very well, Lionel, I'll take it. And he rushed to his fridge and he took out a bottle of Moët Chandon, not the ordinary worker's drink, and he poured two glasses of champagne for himself, Geoffrey Robertson and me, and said, here's to Michael Kirby, his first step to the High Court of Australia. And it didn't come for 30 years later, but it came. And so, and I think my work in the Law Reform Commission was a super useful preparation for the conceptual thinking that is necessary on the High Court. Pity that more justices of the High Court didn't go into a law reform period.
Michael, well then, please, we all know the name, the Australian Law Reform Commission, but what does it do? Where does it fit into our legal system?
Well, it's a federal statutory authority. It's set up by the federal parliament. It's set up effectively to advise the federal parliament on the reform of federal laws that have got out of date or that have never covered a particular area, or that it's been covered in state law or in judge-made law and should be covered by a federal statute that operates throughout the nation. So that is the Law Reform Commission doesn't dream up its own program and do that. It waits for a reference, as it's called in the Act, from the Federal Attorney General, and that means that the elected government of the day has complete control over the program and over the work you do. It's not the same in Leslie Scarman's Law Commission in England, where they make their own program. In Australia, reflecting our different ethos and rather more political society because of federation, it has to wait for the reference from the Attorney General. But I was very fortunate when I began the work in the Law Reform Commission. We had Lionel Murphy as the first Attorney General, and he gave us immediately a program to work on criminal investigation law, which was substantially judge-made law, and also on how to handle complaints against police, which is a perennial problem in all societies. So that's what we set to work doing. After the dismissal in November 1975, I was very lucky that the coalition Attorney General was Bob Ellicott. Bob Ellicott had gone to Fort Street High in Sydney. This is all somewhat incestuous.
It is, Michael. Well, that's what I'm smiling at.
Neville Rann had gone to Fort Street High. He'd had a privileged secular but public education. He'd sat in classrooms with kids from wealthy and not wealthy families. He had no religion pumped into his head. He had a public education, as I did, and he was a magnificent Attorney General. And after the dismissal, he really gave the Law Reform Commission wonderful references on really trailblazing subjects, such as human tissue transplantation, the reform of the law relating to the federal judiciary handling criminal cases, the reform of the law relating to insurance contracts, the reform of the law on privacy. This is all Ellicott. It was pure Ellicott, because though Ellicott was a coalition member of parliament, Malcolm Fraser was actually not a conservative person. Malcolm Fraser, even then and more particularly later, after he'd become Prime Minister, was quite a radical sort of a thinker. And so the combination of Ellicott and Fraser was very good for law reform, and it meant we were given a kickstart. We had, both under the Labor government of Whitlam and under the coalition government of Fraser, we had an Attorney General who really wanted to make this commission work. And I wanted to make it work, because this was now my baby to run under the references from the government of the day.
In part two of our conversation with Michael Kirby, we will discuss his appointment to the New South Wales Supreme Court as President of the Court of Appeal, his ascension to the High Court of Australia, and his extensive work at the United Nations on issues such as human rights violations in Cambodia and North Korea and the AIDS epidemic. Show notes from today's episode can be found at greenslist.com.au/podcast. There you'll find links to things we've talked about in this episode, a transcript of the show, and some wonderful photos of our guests. If you're enjoying Lives in the Law, please tell your networks, subscribe, rate, and review the show. Your host is former lawyer and Greens List clerk, Michael Green. Our show is produced and edited by me, Catherine Green, mixed and mastered by Windmill Audio, and recorded by Alex McFarlane, who also wrote and performed all the music for the series. We're coming to you from the iconic Owen Dixon Chambers on the corner of William and Lonsdale Streets in our beautiful city of Melbourne. We acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation as the traditional custodians of this land and pay our respect to their elders, past and present. There is no doubt that conversations about justice have been taking place on this land for thousands of years, and we are privileged to continue that discussion here today.